The hacker activist group Anonymous has taken down the websites of Sony, the Motion Picture Association of America, and even the CIA. But for all of the chaos they've created, the group hasn't been all that well understood. Joining me now for a look at Anonymous, its members, and the way it seeks what it sees as justice is Quinn Norton, a contributor to Wired magazine. She's written a three-part series about Anonymous that's been published on the magazine's Threat Level blog. I'm very pleased to welcome her to today's first Backstory segment. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Most of us have only heard about Anonymous in the last few years. How far back do its origins go?
Well, mostly the last few years. The board that it comes out of started in 2003, and it's hard to know exactly when Anonymous becomes Anonymous, as opposed to just the users of the 4chan board. So probably somewhere in the 2005, 2006 range.
But it grew out of activity that probably began almost right after the Internet began.
Yeah, I would say that it definitely traces roots both in its aesthetics and its values back to the hacker underground in the 80s and 90s.
Does anyone have any idea how many people are part of Anonymous?
No. It's really, really difficult to define what one means by part of Anonymous. So there's those who kind of actively use that as it's termed by anthropologists like Biela Coleman, improper name. But there's also people who kind of don't use the name but kind of prank in the spirit of there's tens of thousands of users of B, the particular subdivision of the 4chan board where this got started, but nobody's entirely sure how many there are, actually, because the whole point of B, in a way, is that it doesn't log anything. So it's really hard to nail something like that down.
You've said that listening to a record album inspired by Anonymous gave you insight into the group. In what way?
I realized that there's a sense of kind of like the toolkit of a culture in anthropology, all the things they use to do the things that humans do in that cultural frame. And it was just kind of the click-in moment. Like, I had been immersing myself in the imagery, and I had been spending time on 4chan, and I saw links to these albums created, and it was my kind of own gestaltic moment of going, well, what creates albums? Cultures create albums.
And different and kinds of communities.
Time. Yeah.
I mean, you have people who are, there are skinhead communities that produce certain kinds of albums. There are, there are heavy metal communities that produce, et cetera, goth communities. Is this a very different kind of community?
Well, so what I see, the divide that I see that's interesting is that those communities are embedded into a wider culture, and that's kind of how I see things with Anonymous. Now, it's an online culture. It's arguably a subculture, but no part of Anonymous is not unanimous. No part of it kind of agrees with the rest of it. But it's still kind of bound together by this series of aesthetics, and there's no way to throw anyone out. Communities have methods of exclusion. Cultures don't really.
How do members of Anonymous communicate with each other?
So I usually use the word participants instead of members because there is no membership process, because there's no way to throw anyone out or welcome anyone in. But how they communicate with each other is generally online. Now, the exception to that is things like the protests against Church of Scientology, where they actually meet face-to-face, usually masked, though. So online, there's a lot of the core communication is done on something called IRC, or Internet Relay Chat, which is a large, fairly difficult-to-use chat server system dating from the 1980s.
But that means that other people can also monitor what they're saying. Wouldn't that undermine their anonymity to some degree, or at least undermine the secrecy of their latest projects?
So usually what happens is there's a wider discussion in the public, and not just on IRC, but also a lot of it's on Twitter and some of it's on Facebook as well. And obviously all of that can be seen by everyone, including journalists like me. But then when certain divisions of Anonymous, like AntiSec, which is the one that probably gets the most press, that's short for anti-security, decides to plan one of their raids or one of their actions or operations, they'll go off with a slightly more trusted group of people and discuss something in a secret channel or over encrypted communication methods. And whether or not those are infiltrated is a matter. It's one of the things that's interesting about that is when they go off, they don't then just tell each other their names, as far as I know. They remain anonymous even when they're in secure communications, which is, I think, one of the reasons they're kind of hard to catch.
And they also seem to be developing their own language to some degree, although there is an awful lot of profanity and an awful lot of offensive discussion. I guess that's their way of putting other people off.
Well, this actually arises a lot out of 4chan, but it also arises out of the internet in general. Two things kind of drive this. One is it's an exclusionary language. They use very socially unacceptable terms to kind of delineate a space that's outside of social norms. Not because they necessarily support those ideas. In fact, the same people who will use a lot of racist terms will go after groups they perceive as racist and punish them because it's against their value system, which seems like a contradiction, except they're using these words in a completely different way. They're using racist, sexist, and offensive language to kind of say, you're stepping outside the norms of society, and if you can't do that, you don't belong in this space. If anything, it's kind of a warning as much as it is an actual pushback against the person. It's like, beyond here, worse things lie.
And then we have lulzing. I'm learning a lot of words in discussing Anonymous.
Well, one of the other things that comes up is that one of the other things that drives this language is both the desire to kind of create an in-group. So every in-group develops its own kind of set of shibboleths and ways of signaling in-group participation, and Anonymous is no exception. And also it's heavily influenced by and laden with technical terminology, because technical ability helps status within communities like Anonymous and hacker communities. They are not synonymous. Anonymous is not all hackers, and not all hackers are Anonymous. I should make that clear. Lulz, this is an interesting core value to Anonymous, coming from the proximate source is 4chan, and Lulz is a corruption of LOL for laugh out loud, and it's this idea that a kind of fundamental humor drives action, and that fundamental humor can be as cute and sweet as putting captions on funny pictures of cats, and as horrible as attacking and destroying a fairly inoffensive bystander's life. And Anonymous raids, as they're called, have kind of spanned that from, really genuinely sweet and funny things to things that are pretty impossible to defend from any kind of, ethical or moral stance in modernity.
Is this a prankster aspect? Reminds me of the provost of the Netherlands years back, growing out of Dadaism. Is this what distinguishes these people from WikiLeaks, which doesn't seem to have much of a sense of humor?
I do think actually that is a strong value that's different between the two groups. Additionally, the sense of anonymity is a very, very different value between the sort of people who are kind of in the WikiLeaks camp and the sort of people who end up as Anons.
We don't know. There's no Julian Assange of Anonymous.
There is no Julian Assange of Anonymous, and Anonymous has been tremendously good at resisting celebrity and overt leadership. And really, in my deeper exploration, even covert leadership isn't something that really stands for very long within any particular part of Anonymous. I really do believe that while concentrations of power pop up for specific actions, they melt away, and the sense that there are leaders isn't the sense that leaders are required is just not actually the same within that community. An important point about anonymity, though, I want to make is that, and this, again, distinguishes it from a lot of other hacktivist groups, including WikiLeaks, is that anonymity, I think that the idea that it's about not being tracked, avoiding law enforcement, all that, plays a secondary role to this very core value that being an anon means it doesn't matter who you are in the rest of the world.
Do you think it bothered them that you were tracking them and wound up writing a three-part series about them?
I am sure it bothered some. I have mostly received a positive response, and I think that that's because, again, I've been kind of tracking hackers. I've been studying hackers and writing about hackers for the better part of 20 years now. And they value, and this translates across every hacker community I've interacted with, including Anonymous, they value accuracy and forthrightness above most other things. And I have always walked into the communities that I've dealt with and said, this is where I stand, this is what I'll do. If you don't like it, don't talk to me. And my feeling is that people have responded, within the community, have responded pretty positively to that. And since they knew what they were getting, since I was very what you see is what you get, I think even when I'm critical, it's a fair cop. They're fairly okay with it.
Quinn Norton is a contributor to Wired magazine. She's written a three-part series about Anonymous that's been published on Wired's Threat Level blog. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned their first fight, which was with the Church of Scientology. What provoked them to retaliate against the Scientologists, and what kinds of tactics did they use?
I wouldn't call it their first fight, but I would call it probably their first major fight, just to delineate that a little bit. And interestingly, what this arose out of was a Tom Cruise video that came out in 08, I believe, 07, 08. And the Tom Cruise video was kind of hilarious. It's an internal church video, and it's just very shocking if you're not well into Church of Scientology terminology. It just looks really weird. It leaked out of the church, and the church immediately tried to get rid of it, bring it down, legal nastygrams at people that hosted and all that. And the Anons really liked that video because it was very lulzy. It was very laugh out loud, and they fought to keep it up. And this got them directly into conflict with the church. As far as the tactics they used, they're still actively protesting the church. Here in San Francisco, where I am, there's 1 to 2 protests in front of the Church of Scientology every week.
So people actually show up, but the way they maintain their anonymity is that they wear Guy Fawkes masks, the kind that the character in the book and the film V for Vendetta wore?
Yes. And they show up, they dance. They play music, they dance, they hold funny signs, they write with chalk on the sidewalk. There's a woman there that usually bakes something every week and, you know, walked up to me when I was visiting with a Reese's peanut butter cookie and a Guy Fawkes mask. And they really tried out everything on the Church of Scientology. They did the physical raids, at protests, to everyone else. They hacked their servers, you know, on the other side of legal. The protests are perfectly legal. Hacking servers, obviously not. They denial of service attacked their servers to kind of bring them offline with traffic. They did threatening phone calls. They sent unpaid pizzas to their offices, all sorts of different things. And there were a group of Anons that wanted to protest in a much more traditional political way. And I think eventually they kind of pulled the hive mind. They refer to themselves as the hive mind, a little bit more towards traditional political action as a result. But there were still a group that just wanted to kind of make fun of the church, and they still do to this day. No tactic was ever lost to Anonymous, and it tried out every tactic on the Church of Scientology. This Church of Scientology was like a protest lab for Anonymous. But the tendency has tended towards more political, traditional protests and more kind of in the hacktivist. I'm not sure I like that word, but kind of with air quotes, hacktivist attempts data breaches and that sort of thing, which we've seen kind of develop into other operations. You saw a lot more traditional stuff. And again, these tactics were all tested out with the Church of Scientology, going on even to Optinesia, which was the first of the Freedom Ops, which are kind of the operations very few people can argue with that Anonymous has done, where they were doing things like getting media out from the street in Tunisia and back into places where other Tunisians could see it and to the wider media out in the world, and trying to keep internet connections open and pass data around for people protesting on the ground in Tunisia.
They got involved in Arab Spring in general, not just Tunisia.
Yeah.
How did they react when Hosni Mubarak, then the president of Egypt, turned off the internet during the protests there?
There was a mighty howl from the hive mind that night. I was in channel. I was in the Op Egypt channel when that happened, or during that whole time, and I've never had such a sense of existential dread from a chat channel before, and they were extremely angry. And kind of hit at their core. When you think about, like, when these people are online, when they're participating in a non-culture, the internet is the world. You know, they don't have, you know, they're not going out to the real world. They're taking breaks from their identity as Anonymous to go do things in the rest of the world with their normal lives. But when they're there, that's everything. And the thought that you could just take a portion of the internet and lop it off, I think either they hadn't really thought about that or they didn't understand the emotional consequences of that.
By the way, listeners who are interested in hearing Mayor Bloomberg give his annual State of the City address can do it online through the internet. You can also join a live chat with other WNYC listeners at WNYC.org. And if any Anonymous people want to get involved with that, they're invited as well. Anonymous got upset when people went after WikiLeaks.
There's two common threads amongst the nons. It's probably the lulz is a fairly universal value, and being stridently anti-censorship and pro-free speech. And given that there were no charges ever brought against WikiLeaks, given that a lot of the reaction to them was kind of extra legal, as well as, I'm not sure that they wouldn't have still reacted, but there was a feeling like they were being unfairly censored and shut down. And that's like any time there's a push to limit speech online, it kind of gets the hackles of Anonymous up.
So what prompted them to go after Sony and then PBS and the CIA, I understand, because it sounds like the sort of thing that they would go after. But PBS?
Remember, the other one is the lulz, is this kind of laughter quality. Now, for people, many, many, many people who are especially in anti-sec have worked in the security industry. And the security industry is often extremely frustrated with how not seriously the rest of the world takes it. So the reason Sony was compromised 19 to 20 times over a four-month period in 2011 is because they made it so easy, and people were just kind of, I think, in the security community getting sick of the fact that they wouldn't take it seriously. So there's a quality to this of just going, if you're going to make it so easy for us, we're going to make fun of you. If you won't encrypt your data the way you should, the way best practices indicate you should, we're going to embarrass you, make fun of you.
But that seems to go against their whole idea of openness. Sony was being open. They want it both ways.
I think there's some nuance to this. There's openness of kind of communicative information, and then there's taking, you know, there's the difference between privacy and secrecy. And there's also, you know, and secrecy is kind of usually a set of numbers. And I think they're not necessarily thinking everybody should have to put up their Social Security number online. I mean, they are Anonymous. But there's definitely a value to protecting. If you've been entrusted as a powerful person with all, you know, millions of people's personal data, and you don't protect that, that gets very frustrating with simple-to-do measures. I mean, a lot of these things, Strat4, the recent compromise, they made a big deal in their notes on what they did, that Strat4 used a software package that normally encrypts the data that they released, but they had installed something that actually disabled that security measure. Stratford had.
So you report that an anonymous member revealed on Twitter that AntiSec had been able to use the Stratford logins to compromise many of the top 100 U.S. government contractors. They hinted that they'll be attacking them and releasing more material in the coming weeks.
Yes.
I'm not sure what their ultimate goal is there. And they've kind of tied it to their support of the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Yes. I think right now... I do think they do have a double standard when it comes to transparency for the powerful versus the weak. Like, I think the idea that that government should be more transparent than anonymous, I mean, whether or not you see it as in contradiction, I think depends on a greater ethical scheme. But I do think they probably would hold the governments to a different standard than the citizenry. But as far as that... I personally think it's probably true. It exploits password reuse, and most people foolishly reuse passwords, even though you should use a different password on every site and every login that you do. That's obviously kind of hard for people to do a lot of the time. But if you haven't, then if one place that you use is compromised, they can use that to attack something else that you use.
Anonymous also announced that it will join Reddit's announced blackout next Wednesday in protest of the Stop Online Piracy Act, known as SOPA. They're going to shut down for 12 hours. Have we seen any other anti-SOPA attacks from Anonymous so far?
I think we'll probably see some more stuff. Right now there's been a doxing. Doxing is the term for gathering up information into kind of a dossier and publishing that dossier of representatives that have supported SOPA. So all of their information that they could usually from public sources in that case. Now, I would caution you from saying Anonymous is joining a blackout, because it's like saying Californians are joining a blackout. There's mm-hmm. a usefulness to calling it a culture. A group of Anons is joining the blackout.
You mentioned that there's a lot of diversity here. Does that mean that we're going from left to right, or from left to less left?
Oh, no, we're going from left to right. There's a lot of Ron Paul supporters in Anonymous.
And so is there a certain amount of an internecine war here?
You know, yes, and there always has been. Every time somebody questions me about a specific op, not every time, but almost every time they'll say, oh, I found this other thing saying that wasn't really anonymous. What do you say to that? And what I say to that is there's always one group of anonymous saying that every high-profile op that they don't agree with wasn't done by anonymous. I don't think in a group that doesn't have any formal membership you can actually say whether or not that's true. There's a perpetual state of conflict inside of Anonymous, and it's fairly stable and not terribly consequential in my experience.
Just one other thing, Quinn. Governments have gone after WikiLeaks. Have they gone after Anonymous as well?
Yes. There's ongoing investigations of LulzSec and AntiSec, which are both these kind of, LulzSec was the hacking campaign you referred to earlier with PBS. And, one thing about the PBS thing is that was obviously a little bit closer to home for all journalists, but they also, it was a Lulz campaign. They did put up a false news story saying that Tupac and Biggie Smalls, the deceased rappers, were alive in New Zealand. That was one of the things that made that worthwhile for them to do.
Well, in the beginning, when they took down a website, they would put up something that was kind of funny to replace it. So that's, I guess, the Dadaist side of this whole campaign. We thank you so much for being on our show today. We have links to all three of your articles about Anonymous on our show page at WNYC.org. And the series has been published by Wired Magazine's Threat Level blog. Thank you so much, Quinn Norton, for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.